Good evening and welcome to tonight's lecture. Bonnie Graham McDougall is an associate professor of architecture at Cornell, where she has been a member of the faculty since 1980. From 1983 to 1988, she served as director of the Cornell South Asia program, and from 1985 to 1988, director of the Cornell Syracuse South Asia Language and Area Center. She is currently the university trustee of the American Institute of Indian Studies and a member of the Executive Committee of the South Asia Program. Professor McDougall received a Bachelor of Arts degree, a Master of Arts degree, and a PhD degree from Cornell University. She has held teaching appointments at the University of Washington, the University of Minnesota, the United States Department of State, the University of British Columbia. In 1979, Professor McDougall was a Fulbright Fellow lecturing in the Department of Sociology of the University of Sri Lanka. She is the author of numerous publications on the language, culture, and architecture of the South Asian world area. Please join me in welcoming Bonnie as she speaks to us tonight on Indian architecture and the mythic imagination.
See if I can. Now, is that where it's supposed to be? I can be heard? This device makes me a little nervous. Can you hear me?
No.
Yes, no. Well, I'll move it over front and center. Well, wait a second, right about there. This may take a while. Wait a second. What about now? Can you hear me now? Okay, I'll try to speak up. If it gets too loud, let me know. I'd like to, I'm not presuming any prior knowledge of the material record in India or of Indian architecture, so I'd like to divide this presentation essentially into two parts. The first part, which will be a kind of thumbnail sketch of the material record of Indian architecture and what the Indians have managed to accomplish over two millennia, I will try to summarize in 10 or 15 minutes in order to give those of you who have no prior familiarity with the history of or the diversity of architecture in India with a sum of that record. And in the second part, I'll move on to the main docket, which is architecture and the mythic imagination. Lights and could I? I think I'll just have darkness. This is the contemporary political map of India, and it is coincidental with what Indians, and more particularly Hindus, regard as a sacred territory. The material record of India, particularly of Indian temples, are linked together in networks of related structures, which may bridge one area or another in pilgrimage circuits, which link temples of, say, the god Shiva or the god Vishnu or the mother god goddess into great circuits. According to popular Hindu thought, the area, the sacred area of India, is seen as something of a triangle, with four great, or some say more, sacred temples at what might be regarded at its cardinal points. It is simply a matter of coincidence that the modern area of India in South Asia, its political map, is more or less coincident with this sacred territory, which is networked through these lines and links through sacred temples and other buildings. The point I wish to make is that India has its own sacred geography as well as a political geography. And secondly, that buildings are not regarded as points in isolation, but as links in some larger sacred geography. Some of the, if you're not familiar with the territory of India, some of the areas I'll be talking about, I might point out in the map. I'll be talking a little about temples in the state of Orissa, which is over there, I think, on your right and shown in a kind of ochre color. You could see on the north, I'll say something about the state of Punjab, which is far up there on your left, shown in green, and then the areas to the south, particularly Tamil Nadu, shown here in the far southeast. According to, I think, contemporary popular belief, the architectural history of India begins, or at least as it's conventionally written, with the coming of Indo-European peoples into South Asia, where other peoples speaking Dravidian languages probably were already living. Today, these particular peoples are sort of neatly segregated into two separate bands of cultural areas. The Dravidian-speaking people, who are more ancient in the territory, occupying the southern states of Andhra Pradesh, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, and Kerala, and an Indo-Aryan band speaking languages that are distantly and relatively remotely related to English in the northern part of the territory. There are some disturbances in this general pattern, but that is essentially it. When these Westerners came into India, they found people already living there who lived in what they called poors or cities. They didn't like them very much, but there was already a material record, an urban civilization in India, and the people who came in, who are the ancestors of these northern Indians, were essentially herders, nomadic people, with no material tradition because they were not settled. Eventually, they began to develop a tradition of building sacred altars, and according, again, in the popular imagination, it is from this tradition of sacred altars that a whole edifice of Indian architecture was eventually built up with these two sets of people welded together. The Aryans, as they are called, came into India roughly around the time 1500 BC or so, give or take a few hundred years. And there was a material record built up over the next, say, 1500 years or so, but it is now mostly an archaeological matter because the buildings built were not permanent. And so we really get down to the dawn of the Christian era before we see a building tradition which lasted for us to reflect on, that was built in more permanent materials such as brick and stone, before we see this monumental tradition emerging in Indian culture. I think what I'm going to do in order to... The tradition that we'll be looking at is diversified among various religious groups. Some of the tradition is Buddhist, some of it is Hindu. I don't know whether somebody is looking at me or not. The person changing the slides appears to have given up. These happen to be young novice monks in Sri Lanka. You may have to change the focus from slide to slide because they've been made like the buildings of India at various times. Or Hindu, this is a Hindu aesthetic in a mountain region of India. And one of the first things that we see in the material record are the Buddhist stupas. The great Buddhist stupa at Sarnath, and this is a tradition which grew up roughly around the time of Christ. The Buddha died in the 6th century B.C., and thereafter we have a tradition of reliquaries growing up around his memory and remains. This is the great stupa. The former is in the eastern part of Uttar Pradesh. This is in the western part of India, the great stupa at Sanchi. And other kinds of Buddhist traditions. This is a particular interiorized stupa at the cave temples of Ajanta, which are located in mid-eastern India. And this exemplifies a novel and tradition in the development of Indian architecture, and that is rock-cut architecture. These particular halls for worship represent a tradition, as I said, in rock-cut architecture, in which the interiors of buildings, rooms, were hollowed out from the living rock. And so what you're looking at here is essentially a cave, sometimes called a cave, but they're not really caves because people just started into the mountains and created these kinds of rooms. They replicated, it is said, buildings that were already represented in wood or in some other material, and you can see the staves on the ceiling, which call to mind wood architecture, and the pillars and so forth, but they have been replicated in stone. These are particular kinds of, in quotes, buildings which have interiors but which lack exteriors because, in this particular case, there are over almost 30 of them in various stages of completion organized around a particular riverbed on the side of a mountain with just sort of little holes in there and so forth. If you knock down these pillars, in other words, there would be no structural consequence because, like a cake of soap, all these things are hewn out of the rock. This particular kind of tradition really reached its quintessence in the Kailashanath temple at Ellora, where you have, this is axon of it, and these slides are pretty dark. I really couldn't see it on the light table, and I hope you can see them a little better, in which you have what is essentially the replication of a structural temple carved out of the side of a mountain. Let me see if we can see this a little better in the next one. Here, it's very dark, and I'm having trouble seeing it with the light, but as you see, something that is reminiscent of what you might recall of the Hindu temple. This is the size of the Parthenon. Was carved out in essentially the same manner. It has a couple of stories. It has interior rooms. People just went at the side of the mountain with chisels and so forth, carved it out, and made a building. It's not the way we generally think of making buildings. We generally think about building them up from elements rather than cutting them down from sides of mountains. But this is one important tradition in Indian architecture. These things are around 6th, 7th century B.C. now, which really sets it off from many other traditions of the world, and is really relatively rarely found. These are plans here of various temples in the south, which also represent a similar tradition in rock-cut architecture. These things happen to be models. It is said that people were playing around with to try to decide what should be the quintessential form of the southern temple. And so we have very small temples built up in the same manner. These are at Mahabalipuram. They're roughly contemporaneous with the structure that you saw previously at Kailashanath, in which this is formerly a solid piece of rock, and the temples are essentially chiseled out from it. These are different kinds of models, which replicate models built in wood or stone, or in this case, perhaps a thatch roof, in order to decide perhaps what the form of the southern Indian temple should be. This is another shot of the area, and these are, let's see if we can, these are some cornelians in front of one of them, which will give you an idea. These are not the size of the Parthenon. They're miniaturizations. It's an architectural experiment in which various models were laid out in one place. This is a particular type of temple form, which is a stepped pyramidal form, which is the type of temple which eventually predominated in the south. It is one of these small models. It became the model, essentially, in southern India for the future. This is its manifestation, that particular model, the stepped pyramidal form of the upper temple. This is the shore of temple at Mahabalipuram, and this is a structural temple. It is reminiscent of other temples of the south in this great spire that goes over it, its stepped back nature. This is also around the 7th century. One of the first efforts to build structural temples, and one of the best preserved of the remains. These are the interior areas of that particular temple, which show the central core of the temple built up on a square. I'll be talking about that as we move down the lecture. This is another shot of the shore temple at Mahabalipuram. this is the southern temple, kind of a pyramidal form, which is, emerges in the south. The Kailashanath temple at Kanchipuram, again, the same kind of general feeling about it. And when we move to other areas of India, we have similar kinds of structures, although they, in this case, they have an ellipsoid parabolic feature to the exterior of the spire, rather than a pyramidal form. These are this is kind of the quintessential form of the Arisen temple in the east. This is the Parasurameshwara temple in a kind of small model again. Early temple, 7th, 8th century in Orissa, which shows the quintessential Arisen form. One thing you cannot see from this particular diagram, but one thing is characteristic of all Indian temple facades, is that they are very richly sculptured. This is a very simple form, again, a small interiorized room where the shrine is, and usually a central a court or pavilion. The worship area is essentially private, interiorized. It's called a womb room. It's analogized to the navel or the center of the body. And this temples in Larissa get much more elaborate and have many halls in front of them, but this is a kind of preliminary and kind of quintessential form. This is an example of the kind of sculpture that appears on these particular temples. This happens to be the Hindu god Ganesh. You can see that various people have wandered around the temple, have put little flowers on there to venerate him for good luck. He is important deity. He's the remover of obstacles. Someone you should call to mind when going forth on a journey or in any. All right, any good undertaking. These another type of temple form. This particular temple is in Khajuraho. Can you hear me now? In central India, and you see that this particular form is different from the other two. All of them recalling, as I will go into further in the lecture, something of the nature of the mountain, the central mountain, and so forth. These forms, the kinds of forms that I've characterized as sort of Hindu or quintessentially Indian, are different from things that appear subsequently in the material record as a result of Mughal influence, which came along much later, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries until the coming of the Europeans. And the kinds of forms that we're often confronted with as Indian in the West are often reminiscent of this Mughal period rather than of Hindu architecture of the temple period. These particular forms here are from the great city at Fatehpur Sikri, and these are the kinds of things which are promoted by Air India and appear on, say, Indian restaurant menus and so forth, and which also have recently found their way into the Indian architectural idiom as something that is quintessentially Indian, that is when Indians are doing postmodern architecture and searching for their roots architecturally, it is these kinds of forms, like the ones from Fatehpur Sikri, which come to mind. This particular temple is a kind of composite form which is found in Chandigarh, India, and it's actually a Hindu temple. And you can see it does not recall the earlier forms of Hindu architecture, but more accurately, the Mughal period. This, of course, another, the great architecture of the Mughal period, exemplified not only by Fatehpur Sikri, but by the funereal period, the Taj Mahal. And the Indian architectural record also contains many popular and folk forms which stand outside this tradition, and happen to be very colorful, a very colorful entrance to a temple of the god Ayyanar in the south, a regionalized tradition and a folk tradition, and another feature of the exterior of the same temple, a different kind of idiom. Might go back. Wait a second. I don't know whether it's a crucifix. I'd sort of doubt it. I don't think it's a crucifix, but if it is, this building is worth studying. Finally, I want to say that in preparation for what is to follow is that the Indians have always been very good mathematicians, astronomers, and astrologers. And this kind of knowledge has figured centrally in the development of their architectural theory. This particular astronomical and mathematical tradition is represented materially at certain observatories which were built. They're not ancient. A lot of people presume them to be ancient. They're relatively recent, mostly built by one Maharaja in the 18th century. This is one at Delhi. And all these things are astronomical instruments. This is another one at Delhi. And these particular ones are from the Jantar Mantar Observatory at Jaipur, where you get solar, lunar instruments intended to track the stars and the sun and so forth. Modern architects have always been fascinated with these particular forms. If they know any forms from India, these are often the ones that they mention, ask for, and look for. If I'm asked for slides, often by Western architects, they want pictures of Jantar Mantar. The solar disk there, This is a kind of odd little form. It is the top of Le Corbusier's a legislative assembly building at Tundagar, and at the top of the building there is just a small piece there of solar imagery cribbed from the Jantar-Mantar remains that we've just looked at, which he put on top of his cosmic axis. And you can see here on the top of the building, it's up there. Ironically, in popular parlance in Chandigarh, some people think it's a boat and that it's up there to prevent the city from floating downstream or something like that. This is not just something somebody told me. It's actually written in the most recent issue of the Indian Census. So, so much for trying to rope people into cosmic symbolism. All right, I'll move on to the map, and I'm just going to talk a little before I call any more slides. So that is the material record of India in just a few minutes. All right, let me talk now about architecture and the mythic imagination, which is the main meat today. In a retrospective on the work of Le Corbusier, the European designer of Chandigarh, which I just showed you, which was the post-war capital built in the post-war period of Punjab state. His Indian colleague B.V. Doshi was asked whether Le Corbusier had ever studied any Indian philosophy. He was asked this pointed question because a certain controversy has really swirled around the cultural fit of the design of this Punjab city since its inception in the early 1950s, and most particularly around whether a foreigner, who apparently didn't know very much about India, should have been given a free hand in designing the provincial capital from the ground up. "Oh, I doubt very much that he had read Indian philosophy," Doshi said. "Basically, people who are philosophers don't have to study religions or faiths. He was a very secretive man, and though he was religious, he never admitted it." This is a very surprising thing for Doshi to have said, because Le Corbusier's architecture is considered to be very intellectual and rational. Doshi went on to say, "I think all creative people are mystics in a sense. Otherwise, how come a house that he designed in Paris for Bombay had a ramp which is very similar to the ramp in the Amber Palace at Jaipur, which he had never seen? These people are not only psychic, but at a certain level of creativity, the intuitive level becomes universal." Well, the extensive ethnological record which is compiled over the past century would invite other modes of explanation for similarities, material or otherwise, which are distance from each other in time and space, in this case, 2 centuries and 10,000 miles. Diffusion of borrowing, a common history, chance are the explanation favored by most of us. Neither historians nor anthropologists hold much with psychic connections as first-order scholarly explanations. Nonetheless, Doshi's observation expresses a central insight about the experience of the architect wherever he works and whatever his culture, his beliefs about his craft and his quest. What Doshi inferred from his long-standing collaborative experience with Le Corbusier and what he expressed as an artist is that the sources of aesthetic inspiration are mysterious, they're distant, they're transcendent. Like anyone who has a flash of inspiration, an important insight, the architect is moved by it. He cannot always say where it comes from, or for that matter, when it will come again. So in this secular age, we often have to be reminded that the creation of architecture was rooted traditionally in the religious experience whose metaphorical language can still speak to us and help us understand the aesthetic experience in other societies and in our own. The religious or spiritual dimension of architecture does not refer solely to the fact that many of the great buildings of the past were envelopes for altars or images, or that they were temples or churches or otherwise liturgical in function. Rather, the design of any building emerges from a special kind of vision, not unlike that possessed by the shaman, or in Doshi's words, a psychic, which reveals some other realm of experience or knowledge. It comes from an imaginative leap with and through the eye of the mind to a world which has previously been inaccessible. It is a way in. Design, in the view of the Western designer and in the view of the Indian one, It's a process that makes previously unrevealed order and beauty manifest, and in this sense it calls to mind the miraculous side of vision and experience. Le Corbusier touched on this dimension of the creative experience in his writings on geometric order, in which he comes as close as he's willing to come to his psychic side. In The City of Tomorrow, he wrote that geometry was the material basis on which we build those symbols which represent to us perfection and the divine. Later in The Modulor, he wrote that the creation of order and beauty through architecture was motivated by a single force he called the sense of the divine, which was directed to the single end of creating a paradise on earth. Through these metaphors, he touched on a belief shared by architects and artists through time and across cultures that architecture represents or distills some larger, regular cosmic order which involves us in the perfect and the mysterious. These extra mundane properties of architecture reflect those of other cultural materials, religious documents, for example, which involve a symbolic dimension. Paul Tillich's observations on the nature of religious symbolism apply equally to the mission of the artist, architect, or craftsman, and help to clarify its fundamental nature. He wrote, "The function of symbols is to point beyond themselves, to open up levels of reality which are otherwise closed, and to open up levels of the human mind of which we are otherwise not aware." So the power of the aesthetic experience, like that of the religious imagination, thus lies in its departure from the mundane to a vision which lies beyond the understandings imparted by the commonplace experience of everyday life. It allows us to see something beyond that life, and some societies, not unnaturally, have concluded that it is divinely inspired. Apart from some exceptional individuals such as Corbusier, who wrote nearly as extensively as he built, architects have not always written with clarity of their sources of inspiration, purposes, and intentions. Traditional South Asian architects were exceptions in providing an extensive written commentary on the theory behind form, although the canon they bequeathed to us has raised many questions of interpretation. In 1834, the Indian writer Ram Ras wrote his now famous essay on the architecture of the Hindus, which acquainted an English readership for the first time with the existence of an indigenous written tradition in Indian architectural theory. This canon pertains to the Hindu building tradition, which I've showed you, with emphasis on the temple tradition, and gives some attention to Buddhist and Jain offshoots, which participate ideationally in this common history. The text he described did not apply, however, to the Islamic building traditions represented by the Taj Mahal or by Fatehpur Sikri, now seen as quintessentially Indian in the West. These things arose much later in Indian history and constitute a subsequent chapter. Ram Ras examined many texts on architecture in the Sanskrit language in the hope that, in quotes, a correct account, an accurate elucidation of the arts of building practiced by the Hindus would help resolve questions about the antecedents of its forms, which at that time had been ascribed by some Western writers to Egyptian sources. However, in examining one of the most important South Indian texts, he was obliged to note that a considerable portion of the whole is occupied with minute descriptions of the mysteries, rites, sacrifices to be performed on various occasions in the building of temples, houses, villages, towns, and cities, the ceremonies attending the consecration of images, the mode of determining the propitious moment for commencing to lay the foundation, as well as the rules for predicting the future prosperity of him who causes the edifice to be raised, the aspects of the stars, and so forth. Alas, the other works he looked at contain similar materials. So, although the text provided ample material on the formal organization of Indian buildings, which allowed him to draw some diagrams, they had the troublesome property of interpreting the subject in mystical terms. The author, who was himself an engineer, was very uneasy about how these beliefs would be received in a work on architecture, and therefore he sought to minimize the importance of stuff he feared would be taken as hocus pocus in favor of formal descriptions of buildings, which he thought would be seen as more legitimate. It was paradoxically the insight of an Englishman, the architectural historian William Lethaby, later in the century, that the types of data which Ram Rao saw as unrelated did both fall within the purview of architectural history and were related to each other, although at different levels of interpretation and description. Lethaby noted in his seminal work, Architecture, Mysticism, and Myth, that the history of architecture, as it's usually written, is merely the history of building. Yet, he wrote, as the pigments are but the vehicle of painting, so is building but the vehicle of architecture, which is the thought behind form. This embodied a cognitive view of culture, which anticipated the ways in which 20th century structuralists were going to segregate behavior from cognition, language from speech, and what is known from what is done. He went on to make the unconventional proposal that the goals in the study of architecture went beyond formal description and the construction of taxonomies of styles to the elucidation of the deeper, covert symbolism which linked buildings with cosmological models and religious ideas and infused them with psychological meanings. The main purpose and burden of sacred architecture, and all architecture was sacred in the early days, he wrote, is thus inextricably bound up with the people's thought about God and the universe. His central idea was that there was a psychic connection between the world as a structure and the structure of the building, an idea which has been recently being explored for a whole range of cultures, both in architectural history and in the history of religions. So the South Asian culture area is one in which the symbolic system, which links building and this more general system of order, is given explicit mythological expression in textual materials on architectural history, such as those first called to our attention by Ram Raz. It's a rich repository of such data, which applies to design at various levels of complexity, including houses, temples, and towns. And if you could put on the second set of... You can move on from this one. I was going to rest on that one. In the South Asian culture area, the principles of architectural design are set forth in a body of materials called Vastu Shastra. It is a body of knowledge which, like astrology, with which it shares overlapping content, and Ayurvedic medicine, is one of the traditional South Asian sciences. Like the other traditional science, this is a particular one of the things that I occupy myself doing is looking at folk manuals on this particular science, and I'm currently looking at four of them, two from the Sri Lankan Sinhalese area of Sri Lanka, and two from the Tamil-speaking area of South India. This happens to be one which is written in, written in Gujarati, or it's Sanskrit with Gujarati commentary, and it shows an important graph. I'll talk about this guy in a minute, the man in the square on the cover. This happens to be a popular folk manual. this is the same diagram minus the guy, which shows up again in a manual that comes from the Sinhalese speaking area of Sri Lanka, and another one in Malayalam, which comes from South India. And this guy looks a little like Santa Claus. The knowledge contained in this particular science is personified by Vishwakarma, who you see before you, the pan-South Asian god of architecture, the divine craftsman, who is said to have revealed it to sages and otherwise to inspired scholars and craftsmen by his perfect example. The classical treaties which come down to us are ascribed to the sages. This is another, this happens to be a terracotta sculpture of Vishwakarma again, or in some cases to Vishwakarma himself, and comprise an authoritative corpus. Vastu Shastra is sometimes referred to as the Hindu science of architecture. It is nonetheless a science which incorporates Buddhist Sri Lanka and some peripheral, geographically peripheral traditions as well. It's spread, for example, to Southeast Asia. This is a fairly dim slide. Shows up better in a small space. But it's a picture of Vishwakarma. And it was taken in the College of Architecture, which is a modern college designed by Le Corbusier, at Chandigarh. And this is just hung up in the wood shop there by the people who run it. So even in the grips of the modern master, we find Vishwakarma being venerated by those who work in the creative arts. Architects consider aesthetic questions to be important ones, the challenging ones, because they embody an inspired understanding of universal principles. So architecture is really always linked to the effort to link the particular to the universal. Things are never done randomly or capriciously. Design decisions are usually made, or almost always made, legitimate ones are always made, because they link a particular design to some larger scheme. In contemporary Western traditions, the kinds of more general schemes which legitimate architectural design decisions and architectural theory have been drawn from the sciences, specifically mathematics, and more recently from sociological theory. In a mathematical system, the idea would be that design should be grounded in a set of coherent principles governing their relationships in relationships and proportional systems, as in Corbusier's Modulor. This happens to be a picture of Corbusier's graphic, which represents his proportional systems of buildings. He called the Modulor, all built up on the proportions of the man, the idea of man at the center. In South Asia, these principles, which relate a building to a more general system of order, have been grounded in cosmological models, which are expressed in mythic terms. The historian of religions, Mircea Eliade, has argued that in traditional societies, myth provided a true reflection of events that took place in the beginning of time, and hence is an archetypical model for human endeavors. In South Asia, architectural design theory is grounded in these kinds of exemplary models and acts. The stuff of the architectural manuals, design modules for each of the four castes, proportional systems in the measure of the dwelling, the orientation of the site plan, are correct and true reflections of world order because they were set forth by the gods. Furthermore, architectonic models ascribe to mythic space a sacred mountain called Meru, which stands at the center of the world. The orientation of the world to the eight directions, each of which is bounded by a guardian, are implicit in the man-made plan and recalled in ritual. So I'd now like to go on to talk about some of these principles as they apply to the text. When Le Corbusier laid out his capital at Chandigarh in the early 1950s, he laid out the city, the plan is here before you, in the form of a grid of 46 sectors and likened its form to that of a human body. Among other analogies which emerged in his perception of the city as a complex organism were his reference to the now famous set of buildings known as the Capitol Complex, which he placed in the northeast, a very auspicious direction, as the head of the city, and to his commercial complex, which occupied a more central position, as the stomach. As the recollections of Doshi, which I mentioned before, suggest, Le Corbusier had no specific knowledge of Indian architectural traditions, but when he said these things, he might easily have been regarded as psychic. In the South Asian tradition, the site is likewise laid out as a grid. Here we have, in this case, I've showed you this graphic before, it's likewise laid out as a grid, expressed as a single human body, which is worshipped as a divine presence and which is occupied by 45 additional deities. It is perceived as a square. In the South Asian tradition, the fixed positions of directional guardians, the meaning attached to orientations of the planet space around an oriented center, and the origins of this square are expressed in one of the great cosmogonic myths of the Hindus. It describes the manner in which ordered, oriented space was first conferred on Earth and represented as a named divine presence, which is presented as a human body. I'll tell you one or two variations of this account. According to one classical variation of the account, in the Golden Age, there was once a nameless thing in the realm of the gods, generally taken to be one of the asuras, who are titans or anti-gods in the Indian mythology. It was very troublesome. It blocked heaven and earth. It ate up three worlds, and it outwitted the god in numerous conflicts. The gods finally got tired of this nonsense, seized it, and threw it to earth, face downward, where they settled on it forever in an ordered arrangement within a square oriented to the four directions. And this is its graph. Lord Brahma gave the name Vastu Purusha, the man spirit of dwelling places or abodes, to this railed-in being on earth. Vastu Purusha is therefore ordered space personified as a design being. The oriented polygon in which he resides is referred to the Vastu Purusha Mandala, and such were the circumstances in which the fallen titan, which you see here, came to lie on the earth, which is head in the quarter of light, east-northeast. His head here is in the east, northeast. This particular diagram, like all Indian diagrams of this sort, has the east at the top because that's what you face. So people who reproduce this in Western texts are always turning it around so the north is on the top because that's the way we like to look at things. But in fact, it is oriented toward the east. So if you can follow this, I've tried to orient all these diagrams so the head is in the northeast in the proper place according to the Indians. So with his head in the quarter of light, east, northeast, and his feet in the quarter of darkness, west, southwest. This archetypical image is recalled ritually in the construction and form of all ordered space. As the gods decreed in the beginning, he and through him, the gods who took up their stations forever on his body are to be propitiated by all who build structures in this world for men or for gods. We get somewhat different accounts in some of the more...